Welcome to Safety First with Danger Tate.
Welcome to Safety First with Danger Tate. As the video said, I'm Tate, and this is my show where I interview really cool people about the cool things that they do. Our guest today is one of my favorite people to be on the river with, Steve Welch himself, a return guest for Gear Garage TV. Steve spent most of his life along the banks of the Tuolumne River managing ARTA and guiding, and he now works as a Northwest Rafting Company instructor on the Rogue River, and he splits his time between the Pacific Northwest and New York State, where he has a new grandson. So, welcome!
Welcome. Good morning, Tate. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Mostly really excited to chit-chat with you.
Good to be here. You have to readjust your definition of cool, though, because I don't think I qualify.
Well, but I'm really excited to prove you wrong with that today. We go over all of the cool things that you've done and kind of your influence that you've had on the guiding industry.
I know cool people like you. I consider myself cool adjacent, which is a pretty good spot to be.
Honestly, this is really nice because that's kind of how I consider you. So I feel like with this cyclical cool people circle, we're doing well.
That's why we like each other so much.
Yeah, that's why we're friends. It's perfect. Okay, well, today I'm really excited to talk to you about just kind of guiding as a whole. You've been in the guiding industry longer than I think most people. How long have you been in the industry?
Good question. Officially since 1978, that's when I first started actually working as a river guide. A few years before that as doing private trips. But as far as a river guide goes, 1978, when I was 21 years old.
Wow. How did you find rafting?
long story that I'll share with you. When I graduated from high school in 1976, and that was the year that the Olympics were in Montreal, my mom, for my graduation present from high school, gave me tickets to a bunch of events at the Olympics. And she had bought them off of the classified ads in the local newspaper. Like, we have to go back to that era. Like, think about, that's how things were done back then. A little classified ad in the newspaper. Bought it from somebody. It was a bunch of tickets to random events. But she didn't give me any transportation or lodging. It was just the tickets. Okay. And this was her way of sort of sending me out in the world and teaching myself to fend for myself.
Wait, did you go with a friend or anything, or it was just you?
That's where now we're going to take the right turn that, you know, unbeknownst to me, changed the whole course of my life. I was in California. The Olympics were in Montreal. A friend of mine, my sister's boyfriend in high school, who was a kayaker and had been kayaking in the California rivers for a few years, had been invited on a private trip on the Selway River in Idaho. And so I'm in California. We need to get to Montreal. He's going to Idaho. Idaho's on the way to Montreal. So I'm like piecing together my transportation plan, and I asked him, sort of bartered with him, traded with him, hey, do you want to go to the Olympics? And, oh, let's do the Selway on the way.
What?
On our way to the Olympics, we did a Selway trip, 9 days, 9 day private trip, 3 layover days. It was my first rafting experience ever. I sat in the front of the boat and bailed before self-bailing boats and was intrigued. I loved being out in the wilderness. I'd spent some time, you know, doing backcountry things and outdoor things as a kid. So the camping was fun for me. The fishing was really good. All those great things about river trips, but I didn't get to row. I just bailed and I got a little bored and I got a little frustrated. So I built up that, whatever desire to do more of it during those 9 days. The most fascinating thing, whatever I was, you know, 18 years old at the time. We took off on the Selway. We spent 9 days with just the 8 other people that were on the trip for 9 days, took off of the Selway spent the night in Boise, flew from Boise to the opening ceremonies of the 1976 Montreal Olympics. So we went from this total isolation to this total culture shock, people packed in, people from all over the world. We have nowhere to stay. We don't know what we're doing. But anyway, that was my first rafting trip. That's sort of how I got involved in it. My friend then took me on other private trips for the next couple of summers, two Middle Fork of the Salmon trips. Did a rogue trip in there too, Tuolumne trips in there. And he taught me how to row. I just started following him down the river. And then after 3 years of that, I found out you could get paid to do this. Like there was actually a job. Met some people, started working for ARTA in whatever that'd be, 78 or 79. Woke up however many years later it is. And here I am.
Still. You're telling me that your first trip ever was the Selway on your way to the Olympics. And then the next few rivers that you did were the Middle Fork of the Salmon and the Tuolumne and the Rogue.
Yeah, I've been really, really fortunate. And then working for ARTA, you know, I had access to all of those rivers every summer. So I've been really, really fortunate in that to be able to do those trips.
Do you keep
that's how I got started.
Do you keep a log?
Oh man, no, that would be my one thing. I tell this a lot to when I've taught guide schools or even other rowing schools. If I wish I did.
Really?
I wish I'd been really, really disciplined about it and kept track of all that stuff. And I know people who have, who've done it. I'm really envious of that. Do you have one?
I do. Yeah.
You do?
Like every trip. Even like day trip kayaking.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Bless and you. I try that to write such like, a good thing.
I try to write like who I went with so I can like text them about whatever day it was. So that's good to hear that I should keep doing it.
Please keep doing it. I wish I did. And I know that whenever I tell someone that and then I tell them I haven't done it, they say, you know, it's not too late to start. So I haven't started yet. So.
Well, Steve, it's not too late.
I know. Maybe I'll this summer.
Well, but when you were working and guiding for ARTA, did they keep a log? I'm sure you could find that of like professional trips.
Well, I ran ARTA for those 35 years.
Okay, yeah.
I threw away a lot of that stuff. Like I know, and it would have been really, really hard. There was no, I mean, everything was in paper back then. There was no centralized thing. This is pre-computers, pre any sort of technological way to keep track of the kind of stuff. So to recreate it would have been almost impossible. I have it all up here though. I can remember pretty much every trip and every person that I've been on a trip. Well,
I feel like that's sarcasm, right? But I'm not quite sure.
No, I have a terrible, terrible memory. And as you can imagine, you know, you run into people multiple times in this environment, this world. So it is sort of awkward sometimes when, you know, people remember me and I have to pretend I remember them. But let's change the subject about, let's
okay,
not talk
okay.
about
okay,
the, my shortcomings.
Well, cool people admit their shortcomings. So way to go. You're very cool. okay, let's kind of go back a little bit. So you had your crazy, you checked off almost every bucket list river before you even started guiding. When you started guiding, what was it about the lifestyle that you really liked?
It's a good question. And looking back on it, I don't know if my answer now is the same as it would have been then. And where this comes up in conversation for me at the end of my, towards the end of my career in talking to younger guides or less experienced guides who are starting off in their careers and their desire to run harder whitewater. And by the time I started sort of being in a position where I could evaluate that and advise people on that, that was certainly not a priority of mine. I don't know if it was a priority earlier, like if, you know, running high water Tuolumne trips or running Cherry Creek or doing really, really difficult whitewater was attractive to me. Mm-hmm. It's not now. And when I think of guiding now, the parts that I think were important, even all the way back to the beginning, were the social parts of it, meeting people and facilitating a community in a wilderness setting, you know, for an extended period of time. And I've said this even on those rowing schools where there's whatever, 15 of us, 16, 18 of us going off on a trip for 5 days, where we are probably the only people we're going to talk to for the next 5 days. And that's a really, really rare situation to find yourself in.
Yeah.
To where we're going to create a community and we're going to support each other and survive for the next 5 days in a, you know, foreign or less developed environment. Mm-hmm. And just sort of watching that social chemistry and magic that takes place is what I know I've always enjoyed that.
Yeah.
The whitewater part of it, I don't know if that was when more important to me.
You started guiding just on the Tuolumne, right? Or is that the main place you guided? Or what rivers did you guide?
So the first 5 years up when I was strictly a river guide, when I was working seasonally, before I got a full-time job with Arda, was on the Rogue, and then private trips on other trips on other rivers here and there. But the first five seasons were
on the Rogue. River,
which at that time also for Arda included the Illinois, the Klamath, and the Upper Klamath.
Okay.
So that sort of section of the world was the first 5 years of my career. And then when I started working full-time for Arda, you know, everything else, Idaho, Utah, and the rest of California became more accessible.
Did you have a favorite campsite on the Rogue? And do you now?
No, I do have a favorite campsite on the Rogue. Yes. And I don't know what the name of it. You might.
Uh-huh.
It's just below Quail Creek the left-hand side. When you make that corner, that little inside bend, there's a little pocket in there that I've maybe been able to camp. You can probably put four people at that campsite.
I've never camped there, but I've always heard it referred to as like the Honeymoon Cove.
Yeah, that's a good name for it. I didn't camp there on my honeymoon, but I have camped there with Sandy, my wife, a couple of times. And every time I go by, I'm like, yeah, that's the spot. That's definitely my favorite campsite. Okay,
I'm excited. I'll have to camp there soon.
Do you have a favorite?
I've been looking back through pictures a lot, and I think it's got to be Lower Solitude. There's just so much to do there. Like on a hot summer day, there's nowhere I'd rather be. So, yeah.
You have a least favorite?
I mean, that's tough. They're all great. But if I had to pick somewhere I wouldn't want to stay, I don't love Doe.
Really?
I don't love it. The early shade is nice in the hot summer day, but it's not that I hate it, but I just don't love it. I don't think the swim hole is very good.
You know, you've seen me find my little nesting spot at various campsites. And, you know,
yeah.
I sort of get particular about it. I've never found a home at any of the Tacoma camps.
Really?
Oh no, the Upper Tacoma. I've got
Upper Tacoma spot. Actually, okay, that might be my actual favorite camp because the
that's a pretty cool spot, especially if you get the little
love that little cove
beach over there. I'm happy when that happens. But the other parts of Tacoma, never really found my
that's fair.
My little nest. So that's probably my least favorite.
Okay, you heard it here. That's our Rogue River camp report. If we're on the river the same time, yeah, we'll see. I don't know. The camps on the Rogues are all pretty phenomenal. Okay, I want to take it back to guiding and just kind of your experience with it, because I think my hope is there's people listening who are maybe thinking about getting into guiding, are in the industry now, and there's definitely, I feel like, been a shift that I've felt of going away from you know, just to be blunt, like macho culture in guiding. And now it's shifting to where there's more women. Like it's almost like a 50-50 split, or lately I've seen like more women. And so I'm just intrigued. What do you think has led to kind of the shift?
I think that the river community, and certainly the river community that maybe you and I are more influenced by, which might have West Coast roots, mm-hmm. has always been pretty progressive. Younger people, more open-minded people, sort of maybe not counterculture, but maybe not mainstream. And so I think there's always been that leading or acceptance of change, social mm-hmm. change, environmental change, like progressive people mm-hmm. in the industry. And I think that I'm proud of that. Like that's what I enjoyed about being an outfitter for mm-hmm. as long as I did. Was being around people that thought that way, creative people. Mm-hmm. I think that's a part of it. Even you go back to the 60s, the people that I started boating with, like the mm-hmm. experienced boaters that mentored me, they were progressive people. So I think with the industry has been able to sort of stay on that leading edge throughout that time. And the gender ratio is, you know, an indicator of that. And we, you know, talked to outfitters, that the people that ran Arda back in the 60s, and they talk about hiring the first female guides. I mean, the company had been around for many years before.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, before women were sort of
in it,
allowed or hired. Considered. And, you know, a lot of the women, the early women boaters that worked for Arda or other companies were definitely breaking ground. I mean, it was, but they did the work and it's paying off.
It's paying off big time. It's been really fun. I think especially like looking at like the rowing schools and the private boaters who come to learn how to raft, just the increase in women on the water has been wildly fun to see. We've talked a lot about Arda, or we've just mentioned Arda a bunch, but Arda is a unique rafting company because it's not run like a lot of others. So I'm just, I am curious if you could explain why Arda is different and kind of the ethos of it.
So I'll give you my little short.
Yeah, give me the elevator.
Arda was founded sometime in the late 50s, early 1960s. 1963 is a date that we arbitrarily arrived at because it appeared in some documentation. It's the first time that name was used. Lou Elliott, who founded Arda, had been running trips for the Sierra Club and under different names and sort of different organizations earlier than that. But 1963, we'll just go to that. We'll just pick that date as the beginning. That's before permits existed, and it's before the rafting world, the industry, really took off as a viable business. And Lou, because of his Sierra Club influences, felt that the use of public lands for private gain just didn't feel right to him. Mm-hmm. And so he founded Arda as a nonprofit organization. And it is still a nonprofit organization today. So that fundamentally makes it different. I didn't own Arda. I was a general manager. I worked for Arda. We had a board of directors, still have a board of directors. I reported to the board of directors. It was frustrating at first because makes it hard to working for a nonprofit is different than owning the company.
Right.
I was 25. I was 25, and I realized that what the word consensus meant, as opposed to here's the way I want to do it. Here's what I think we should do. Let's just go do it. That didn't always go over that well in the Arda world. And so it took a while to sort of figure out how to manage that. But that's the fundamental difference. And I think that the practicality of that, the financial implications of that are mm-hmm. that at the end of every season, Arda donates all of its profits, surplus mm-hmm. revenues, to environmental conservation groups.
Whoa.
And so that became that was one of the we're figuring out how to deal with consensus was maybe one of the not fun parts. Mm-hmm. One of the more fun parts was, you know, getting to support a lot of fun grassroots environmental organizations and sort of put our money back into the resource that we were dependent on.
That's really awesome.
Yeah, so it's fun. And then the culture amongst the guides mm-hmm. changes from to where more of a ownership feeling, like mm-hmm. any, like they were employees, I was an employee, like mm-hmm. I didn't own mm-hmm. the company. So that dynamic of owner employee or even owner employee shifted to more co-worker, co-owners, more of an equal authority. And once we all figured out how to sort of manage that dynamic, the company operated much more smoothly. Probably looking back on it, there are probably a lot of guides who worked for Arda at the early part of my career who, you know, would have questioned my support of that philosophy. But I think that I came around to sort of feeling like if we tap into that and embrace it, and if I can figure out how to manage people and find consensus and build community rather than mm-hmm. rely on telling them what to do or making final decisions, we're going to have a much more enjoyable work environment. I think that's where we got by the end. So that's the fundamental difference. And then because it was founded in 1963, before the permit system came into effect, and that was the piece of the puzzle that Lou Elliott maybe didn't anticipate. When the permit system started being implemented in all these different rivers in the Western United States, including the Grand Canyon at that time, Arda had established historical use on all of these major rivers in the West. And so we were granted permits. And then all of a sudden they stopped giving out permits. So the permits had value. And the nonprofit garage pastime hobby idea that Lou Elliott had sort of envisioned for this rafting company became a viable business. And so we remained a nonprofit and still are.
That is really awesome. I had a conversation with Tim Palmer 2 weeks ago, all kind of about conservation and how to get involved. And I think that's cool to see that Arda is just finding ways to donate to those groups.
And Arda tends to attract people for whom that's a important part of their mm-hmm. relationship with the outdoors. There's an educational component, mm-hmm. there's a conservation component, there's an interpretive component that are not wildly different than other outfitters. I think the vast majority of outfitters do a really, really good job of protecting the environment and putting money back into their resource. Art is not that much different in that regard, but because it is nonprofit, sort of the company ethos shifts a little bit more, just a little bit, towards people who do appreciate that and do want to educate people about where they are and that kind of stuff.
I really like that. And I do think that is a cool part of guiding, is being able to share kind of like why the places are important. And so, that's rad. That's the word I've been trying out lately. Rad.
Okay.
But speaking of rad, I feel like that's kind of a word from the 80s. And don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay, so rafting in the 80s to me kind of sounds like the Wild West. Like, I don't know if I could have been, like, I don't know if I could have been in that, but I am curious, do you have any stories of like, oh yeah, that's so 80s from when you were guiding? Or something that like sums up kind of like what rafting was in the 80s.
Okay, I'm going to digress a little bit and talk about life in general.
This is even better.
I think that you've probably had one of these moments in your life so far.
Okay.
You're 23 now.
Uh-huh.
Where you looked back at, let's say, 17-year-old Tate, 18-year-old Tate.
Uh-huh.
And thought, oh my God, I didn't know anything when I was 18.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
now I'm 23 and I know
everything.
So much more.
No, I'm just kidding.
That phenomenon, which I'm sure has a name,
continues.
And I remember as an adult, as a human being, as a person, being in my 30s and thinking back on my 20s and going, oh my God, like I thought I knew what I was doing. And I didn't know anything. But now I'm in my 30s, I got it all figured out. And then in my 40s, looking back at my 30-year-old self and going, oh my God, like, what was I thinking? So sort of that same progression happened in my guiding career.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't aware, we weren't aware of how little we knew and how unsophisticated our trips were. And probably this, you know, starts to infiltrate into some safety issues. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we knew how unsophisticated we were in the 80s until we got to the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, oh my God, look, we have self-bailing boats now. How did we do this without self-bailing boats? Or we know what we have throw bags.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. Like we needed them back then.
Yeah.
And that, you know, continued to the 2000s, the 2010s, 2020, like.
Yeah, even now.
Even now. The satellite phones or satellite texting devices.
Mm-hmm.
I just found out 2 days ago that the new Apple operating system will allow texting from a regular iPhone to satellites all the time. You don't need it. The Garmin, your little Garmin Mini will be obsolete within a year.
Whoa.
From what I understand. So, and I think, oh my God, how did we run Illinois trips, or how did we just went?
Yeah.
We wouldn't even know what the flow was. We couldn't go on the internet and check the flow or things like that. Like there
Whoa,
was just,
true.
It was, and again, I was in the 70s. Let's go back to the 70s or the 80s. Okay. I was rafting with people who had done it in the 60s and they were like, oh my God, it's so, we made a phone call and we do know what the flow is, where in the 60s, we would just show up and put in and go. And we didn't like have any sort of access to that river data. So for them, the 80s were already advanced. So we were sort of like, oh yeah, we're in the safety zone, or we're beyond these little, well, I can't believe you used to do it that way. That sort of has continued.
When you were doing that, like when you're on a river and you had no idea what the flow was and you were just like going, did that fill you with like a calm and like you were in the river flow, or were there ever moments of like, oh shit, maybe we shouldn't be here?
There were certainly moments of, oh shit, maybe we shouldn't be here. There are still moments of, oh shit, maybe we shouldn't be here. I think that was, I mean, obviously being younger makes those things seem less dire.
Oh, interesting.
But I think you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
Like you look back on it and go, oh my God, how could you go if you didn't know what the flow was, or where the takeout was, or if the takeout road was open, or if you had your shuttle figured out, or all those kinds of things that now are like, of course you know that. Of course you know that. You check that. You check that.
Yeah.
Back then it was sort of like, yeah, that's what we did. When I look back on it, it feels very risky, exposed, like unsophisticated. So
do you have a favorite trip of that kind of like feeling of just like complete freedom of not having it figured out, but just trusting it'll work out? Does anything come to mind?
You're romanticizing it a little bit when you say go with the flow and the freedom and don't worry about it kind of thing.
Okay, fair.
I think there, the technology thing would be a place where now we're getting to a point where that's going to infringe on some of that go with the flow, right. Freedom, right. Live in the moment.
Which I think is kind of like the context for the romanticism is, you know, I think the coolest part of being on a river is like not being connected to my phone and being out of service. And like you said at the beginning, right, like connecting with the 18 people that I'm with. And so I think the idea of, you know, even just in a world where there's like, I mean, I haven't lived in a world really without cell phones. And so just what that was like. But also, I mean, you've done so many trips. And so,
It's funny. And it's wonderful to talk about this because, like, not being connected to your phone, the idea didn't even exist. We didn't even think that, even when we were off the river, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have, let alone a cell phone, a smartphone.
Yeah.
There was no sense of, the difference between being on the river then and being on the river and not being on the river then was probably less than it is right now or than it has been for the last 10 years where when you go on a river trip now, you cut yourself off from that technological connection to the rest of the world that we all utilize.
Right.
Whatever, the internet. And that's a big deal. Like, whoa. And people comment on it. People struggle with it. People appreciate it. You appreciate it.
Yeah.
I like being on the river because I can live in that more, that other world.
Yeah.
1980, that other world, the connected world didn't exist. So it wasn't that big of a deal difference between going on the river and not being on the river. And what's interesting is where is that going to be in 10 years from now?
Yeah, good point.
Is the internet going to be so prevalent? Is satellite communication going to be so common? Are, you know, the mini Starlink dishes going to be popping up in campsites? And then the difference between being on the river and being off the river will again be less than it was back in the 80s. So I think that for you and for me, this is the golden era where we can sort of really appreciate what it's like to be out in the wilderness and disconnected from everything because we know both sides of it. Who knows
what it'll be like. Interesting, like you said, of like, okay, in the 80s, we were like, how did we do it in the 70s? In the 90s, how did we do it in the 80s? And in the 2030s, how did we do it in the 2020s?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Of all of the gear from when you started to now, what's like the most revolutionary thing? What's the thing you love the most?
Self-bailing boats changed
everything.
I mean, that's the self-bailing boats are the internet of whitewater rafting. Like that was the
shit. Oh my gosh.
1983.
We should make shirts. Self-bailing boats are the internet of rafting.
Whatever that would be, the spike in the progression curve of what the sport could do and what you could do. And obviously people can argue about when that actually was, but probably 1984 is when self-bailing boats became mainstream and most people had access to them. And that changed the difficulty of the whitewater and the safety fee and like just made everything a little bit different.
Yeah.
Cautioning not to say easier because it'll offend a lot of people. but that was the, you know, you look back, that was whatever the television of our, of whitewater rafting, like one of those monumental improvements and things. The other ones have been more, you know, smaller incremental little bumps along the way. Yeah. But that would be a big spike in the way the sport sort of progressed.
Okay. Self-bailing boats. You heard it here. I really do think we should make like a Gear Garage shirt that says self-bailing boats on the internet of rafting. We'll tell Zach. Actual I think that's perfect. Is gonna be, but
yeah, that was the one. And who is there another one coming? I mean, I don't know that.
Yeah, true.
Anybody saw self-bailing boats coming? I mean,
yeah.
Sotar did and made it happen.
Yeah, true. And the new Taiyi Sotar boats are pretty cool. But okay, enough about gear. I do kind of want to talk a little bit more about your career kind of in the last like 10 minutes or so about
10 minutes.
Know. Okay, you're right.
Maybe we should do another episode, part two.
I'm honored.
A weekly series. Listen to Steve talk about the old days. No,
listen
yeah.
What do you want to talk about? Cool Steve. Yeah.
Cool adjacent Steve.
Guiding is such. So I've been a guide for 4 years, and I love it, and it's really fun, and it kind of becomes your whole life, especially multi-day guiding. And so obviously you did the 5 years guiding and then you kind of switched into the manager role. But I think for a lot of guides in the industry, transitioning careers or even like finding work-life balance between something that they love and that they're so passionate about is really hard. And so what have you done and what have you seen other guides do for like, you're in the industry, you want to guide, you love it, but you also want to have some work-life balance. How do you do it?
I'm really, really lucky. Every day, I appreciate the opportunity that I was given to have that choice or that decision easier. Like I was able to make a living being in the wilderness, being outdoors. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I've seen hundreds of guides like you who want to maintain that balance. And I have no experience having to do that. Again, I'm really, really lucky. So I don't have good advice. I think that you can. One thing I have noticed is, and this was particularly interesting when we would have guides who were on the river like you are, you know, 5 out of every 7 days all summer long, or 7 out of every 7 days, or 30 days in a row, like really pounding it as a river guide. And they'd worked for a couple of years, and maybe we would ask if they were interested in becoming a manager, which would by definition cut their river time down significantly. Michael, Zach both had to go through this, and there was a lot of resistance to doing that. Like, oh, I want to be on the river. I'm only gonna be on the river, you know, 5 days a month instead of 5 days a week. I don't think I can do it. And then at the end of they'll try it for a season or two. And for the majority of them, they became as passionate about managing and that aspect of the business as they were about rafting. And my son would be an example of this. I have a lot of people who transition from river guide to what Arta called an area manager with that same reluctance. and then at the end of the summer, it's like, hey, do you want to go on this trip? And they're like, no, I'm really enjoying these off river projects that I have going on and these things I'm doing. And I'm working on the warehouse, or I'm redoing the menu, or I'm doing these other aspects that they were just as passionate about as they were being on the river. And I think for the, you know, a lot of people, there is something that you will be just as passionate about as being on the river, and you have to trust that, and you have to find that, and you have to believe in that and guide until you find something better. We were talking before the show that, you know, kayaking every day for you right now is really, really fun. and maybe like, oh, maybe I don't want to work on the river as a guide as much this summer. Maybe you're going to go into podcasting. Maybe you're going to become a school teacher. Maybe you're going to become an attorney, a doctor.
That would be a wild change, but I love where your head's at. You're right. I could do anything. Okay.
And I think you would find, hopefully you'll find that you, that going to your classroom as a school teacher every day is as much fun, as much challenge. It presents you with the same sort of good feelings as going, being a river guide.
Yeah. Does.
And that's, you know, my hope for you, for everybody, that they can find that alternative passion. And you still, you will always be able to go back and do river trips, right? Like you can.
I do have a kayak. That leads me to, I've been having this conversation with a lot of friends lately of, you know, do you work to make money to support your hobbies, or do you work with something that like becomes your life? And I feel like I've met so many people who have such differing opinions. What's yours?
Again,
from your life. Yeah.
I could not have dreamt of a better situation for me. It worked out really, really well. I'm thankful for that. I don't want to make it sound like it was always, wasn't easy. And there are, you know, difficulties. Being an outfitter is not always easy. It's fun. In retrospect, I would say it's more fun than anything else, but it's still, there's some downsides to it. Like there are with any job. My wife's a kindergarten teacher. She gets just as much joy out of going to her kindergarten classroom as I do going on the river. And I would prioritize finding your purpose over finding your profession. Like I'm fortunate. I think that my purpose, my passion, or my profession all aligned. And I mean, hallelujah. Thank goodness. I'm really appreciative of that. Sandy's person, passion, whatever.
PPP. Passion,
purpose, and profession all aligned. If you can, and to know that that's possible, to know that that's not a unattainable goal and to work towards it. And yeah, sure. As a profession, maybe I had to, there were some sacrifices in being an outfitter that other professions didn't have. As a passion, I've gone on the river more since I retired than I did when I was working full time as an outfitter. So there's,
that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, Zach is giving up some river time and some of his things because all of them are compromised, but for the most part, if you can find a way to sort of balance those three pillars, I think you can. And to know that it's possible, to know that it's feasible, to know that it's not impossible, it's not selfish, it's not unrealistic, and to be patient until you get there. I think that if you think you need to solve that problem by the time you're 25 years old, you're probably putting a false timetable on yourself. If you trust that it will always, that it'll happen, I think it will.
Okay. I
don't like to give advice, but that's sort of my perspective on that whole thing.
Okay. Wait. So the three pillars were passion, profession, and
purpose.
Okay. Yeah. That's well. And so now, you know, you've kind of switched into retirement. What have you found now? What are the passion, purpose, and profession of retirement? What have you got coming up this year?
I'm writing a book. You know about that. But we're not going to talk about that. That's my novel.
Okay.
It's not
but just for a little money. Plug, what's it going to be called?
Slate Creek, coming soon. I've only been working on it for 15 years, so it should be out within the next 15. Look for it.
Slate Creek by Steve Welch.
Let's make a promise that when my book is published, we'll do a book interview.
Fine. Okay.
I'll send you an advanced copy. You can read it. Then we'll do a little book tour. You'll be the first stop on my book tour. Other than regular life things, teaching the rowing schools has been a really good off ramp for me from the guiding industry. I think that I love those schools. They're, you know, teaching for Zach, teaching for Arda, sharing that knowledge that I've gathered over the years with other people is, you know, really, really fun.
Yeah.
To go on a trip without the responsibility of every, or without feeling the responsibility of every little aspect of it. Like, we did a trip this last spring, a Northwest trip, where there was a glitch in the menu, which to me was not a big deal. If I had been general manager of Northwest Drafting Company, if I had owned Northwest Drafting Company, it might have been a much bigger deal. So to go on a river trip and not have to worry about things like that, which every other trip that I did for those 35 years that I was managing Arda, I could never get away from that buck stops here mentality. The shuttle driver was late. If a boat leaked, if we didn't have enough of this, didn't have enough of that, if a life jacket didn't fit, I felt all of those responsibilities on myself. So to go on trips where I don't have that responsibility has been much more enjoyable. I've been able to sort of relax a little bit more and sort of worry about the things I'm supposed to be worrying about, the immediate instructional part. So the rowing schools, the NDEB rowing schools, the Arda rowing schools have been a really nice transition for me.
Okay, you did say something that jogged my memory of a story that I do kind of want to hear. I'm not condoning pranking. I don't condone it. But there was something with rafts inside.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are...
you can't even do it.
Those are in the vault at this point.
Okay, I'll...
Yeah. I think that a lot of things in retrospect that seemed like a good idea at the time ended up not being a good idea. And then talking about them later makes you look like ignorant. So we will just leave those things in the past.
All right, we won't talk about the pranks.
The people that experience the stories, they can keep them.
Well, for all the listeners, I'll say, if you ever see Steve in public, just ask him about some pranks. But like I said, disclaimer, I don't condone pranking. Pranking isn't cool anymore.
No, not cool anymore.
Hazing isn't cool.
Not cool anymore. No, you know what is cool now that's really been fun? And I think that it's a place where I was unaware of the value that my experience, your experience, commercial river guide experience can have for, let's say, non-commercial boaters. I did a Grand Canyon trip 15 years ago, second Grand Canyon trip I'd ever done. I was a very good river guide, not a very good Grand Canyon guide. Didn't know what was going on. And we camped one night and a major thunderstorm came through, flash flood through the little creek that we were camping near. And it was pretty traumatic. Like, I'd never experienced anything like that before. I was like, and
what time of year was it?
What's that?
What time of year was it?
September.
Okay.
None of us had ever sort of experienced that before. We were, you know, private boaters out there. Once in a lifetime Grand Canyon trip, right? This was my second Grand Canyon trip, 15 years after my first one. I didn't know what I was doing. And in the morning, a guide from the commercial trip that was camped, you know, a quarter mile downstream, hiked up to our campsite to make sure we were okay.
Yeah.
And we were.
Yeah.
And it was, but it was really, really comforting to think that someone out there who knew more than us was sort of checking in on us.
Yeah.
We've been on Northwest trips where we've been able to facilitate some moments for people with less experience than us. And that, those moments of cooperation, and it goes both ways, but those moments of cooperation and being able to sort of, steward the river and the other river users. Mm-hmm. There's more of that now than there was 10 or 15 years ago. I think that there's that the commercial side, the non-commercial side, and the we're all in this together and sharing the resource mentality has gotten better in the last few years. And that's a part of rafting, and it's probably where it spills over into the rowing schools, like being able to share my experience with other people.
I think that that is a good reframe of, you know, where is the river world going? Where is it going in the future based on how it's been? And I do think that is a really cool trend of, you know, it's not just the 18 people that you're on the river with in your group. It's whoever is on and experiencing like the magical place, day trip, multi-day, doesn't matter. Yeah, I love that. Actually, thanks for saying that.
Yeah, sharing the river. I think the share would be the word that I would hope would continue to become more important.
Yeah, that's, wow. I'm like inspired now. I'm like, who can I share the river with next?
Yeah, no, and it's a good thing to think about as you're going down, to just sort of recognize that you can tell people where the cool swimming pools are, where the cool campsites are, where the things you don't want them to miss. And that, you know, that's your gift that being a commercial guide has given you. And it's your responsibility to sort of make sure that that knowledge and sort of safety net gets shared with everybody else that's out there. I think that's a good thing to have in the back of your mind.
Yeah, that's, I'm going to think about that forever. Well, Steve, I really appreciate you talking, and it's clear that you're passionate about the industry and really care about the places. And I think that that's cool. And, you know, just like, as we just said, it's really nice to share it. And so I appreciate you sharing it today show.
If caring about the places makes me cool.
Okay. Oh, thank you for saying you're cool. I agree.
And that sliver of coolness, I will accept.
Yeah. You will accept. You're cool adjacent and cool in your own right. Because you
cool
share.
In that part, yeah.
Yeah. It's like sharing is caring is back in style.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Steve. And
my pleasure, Tate. I can't wait to see you out on the river this summer. Anybody who's watching the show, I can't wait to see you out on the river this summer. If you need anything, you can ask Tate. She knows.
Ask me. And also, we'll see Steve again for either episode 2 or his book tour.
Yeah.
Sometime within the next 15 years.
All right. Hold your breath.
All right. Bye, Steve.
See you, Tate.